Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks. Welcome back, everyone, to Sharkpedia. I'm your host, Megan. We are without our fearless leader, Imani, this week. She was not able to be here with us, but I'm so excited to be here today with Akshay Tanna. He is working in Sri Lanka, and I'm so excited to talk about sawfishes in Sri Lanka. So thank you so much, Akshay, for being here. We're so excited to have you on our podcast.
My pleasure. I'm really happy to be here, too.
And could you just quickly, for our Sharkies, introduce yourself and some of the work that you do in Sri Lanka?
Sure. So I'm Akshay Tanna. I'm the Director of Operations at Blue Resources Trust. So Blue Resources Trust is a Sri Lankan marine nonprofit. We kind of started operations in 2017, and we have two major programs. So one of them is a coral reef program, where we primarily monitor coral reefs around Sri Lanka, particularly one on the east coast of Sri Lanka, where we also have a field station. And so we are monitoring coral health and fisheries from that reef since 2017. The other program that we have is the Sri Lanka Elasmo Brand Project, where since 2017, again, we've been documenting shark and ray landings across the country. So every day we have between 2 and 5 researchers going to various landing sites and documenting all the sharks and rays that are being landed, talking to the fishers, trying to get some information on where they're catching them, what gear they're using, and sort of setting up a database of all of these landings. So those are our two major projects, and as Director of Operations, I oversee both of them.
Wow, that's really great. One of the things that I'm most excited about talking with you today is about fishers' ecological knowledge, also known as FEK. That's something that Imani and I are constantly trying to advocate for on our podcast, because it's just so important to work with your fishers and talk with them about their experiences, because they have so much knowledge about what they see in the field every day when the researchers aren't necessarily out there. And we can't do the conservation work we need to do without that ecological knowledge that they provide. So that's one of the things I was super excited about this article that we are going to review with you today. You really talk about that. That's the whole article, is talking about pulling from that ecological knowledge. That's really great. So you started in 2017. Was there very much conservation work with elasmobranchs or corals before that? Like, what does conservation look like in Sri Lanka?
So Sri Lanka has always had a fairly long history of conservation initiatives. There have been many organizations before us as well, and enthusiastic individuals as well, who've documented both coral reefs and sharks and rays in Sri Lanka. The government research agencies, of course, have also done their part, and they do as well document this data quite thoroughly, I would say. But there is a lot of room for more people to get into it, and that's one of the reasons why we started. We also wanted to be a platform for Sri Lankan students to take up these studies. So one of the issues was that if you wanted to take up marine science before we were around and before a couple of new organizations, the only way you could do that was to try and get an internship at a government lab or something like that. There wasn't much else. So the two co-founders, Nishan and Daniel, who run both the programs I speak about, they decided that they wanted to start something to help Sri Lankan students. And I came on board as Director of Operations, and that's what we've been doing since then.
That's
so
really
yeah, there has been some work. A few books as well have been published on sharks and rays in Sri Lanka. But I would say we are the first sort of systematic private organization to be doing this long term.
Wow, That's really great. So you have students that work with you quite a bit. Is that something that you advertise for students to come work with you?
Yes, so we do have a lot of Sri Lankan students who join us and do components of the research that we do as part of their thesis, so usually an undergraduate or a master's thesis. So we do encourage that quite a bit. And off the top of my head, I would say about 15 students since we started have come in through our scholarship program, joined us, and done their thesis work with us. And this is something that we fund. So they don't really pay us anything, or it doesn't cost them anything. We fund all the research, their travel, and everything. So yes, that's something that we support.
Wow, that's really excellent. Those are programs that are often very far and few between. So it's really great to know that that is a resource for Sri Lankan students to be able to utilize for the research that they might be hoping to do for their career. So that's really great. Well, I'm really excited, again, to talk about this article that you wrote today. The article that we're talking about that Akshay authored is Where Have All the Sawfishes Gone? Perspectives on Declines of These Critically Endangered Species in Sri Lanka. So I'll give you all a quick summary of this article. All five species of sawfishes are amongst the most threatened marine fishes in the world. They were historically reported in Sri Lanka, but records and sightings have been increasingly rare in recent years. Fishers can provide that critical fishers ecological knowledge that we were just talking about, and this helps fill in the gaps for historical records. Therefore, Akshay and his colleagues set out to interview 300 fishers around Sri Lanka to survey their experience with sawfish. Of these fishers surveyed, only 39% could identify sawfishes, and 30% that had seen sawfishes had not seen them since 1992. Only 10 fishers had seen sawfish in the last decade, indicating a clear population decline. Fishers indicate their perspectives that they believe this decline in sightings is due to increased fishing pressure, which coincides with the fishing effort in Sri Lanka and the development of aquaculture industry. And we're going to break all of this down with Akshay. It's likely that this species is now functionally extinct within Sri Lanka's marine ecosystems. So again, I'm so excited to talk about this. I think this is such a critical thing. I'm actually trying to hone in these skills as well, talking with fishers and trying to work with them in a way that we can get that ecological knowledge from them. But before we dive into all of that, Akshay, do you mind telling our listeners, could you explain what functionally extinct means? What does it mean that the sawfishes are likely functionally extinct?
Sure. So, I mean, extinct is a word that's quite commonly used, but functionally extinct is slightly different, so I'll explain that. All species have a role in the ecosystem. So if you look at our big sharks and rays and killer whales, for example, they eat smaller fish. So they control population dynamics and the prey populations. Something like birds, for example, they disperse seeds. Bees and insects would be pollinators. You know, without them, we would have no pollination and no food crops. So all of these animals, they have a functional ecological role, and they can only do that when there's enough of them around, when their populations are large. And with sawfishes, what we found is that their populations are probably so low that they can't perform any functional role in the ecosystem anymore. So they're definitely commercially extinct, which means that it's not worth the effort to go looking for sawfishes to fish them. It'll cost you more than what you'll get from fishing a sawfish. So commercial extinction probably happened a long time ago, but now we think that there's also a functional extinction because they haven't been seen for so long. They're not completely extinct in the sense that you might find the odd sawfish somewhere, but they're not fulfilling their ecological role in the ecosystem anymore. And the populations are basically so low that they can't recover. And, you know, they'd potentially be totally extinct in Sri Lankan waters soon.
And you mentioned in the article that records indicated that there was likely two species of sawfish. Can you quickly explain to our listeners what species those were and how do you typically identify those two species of sawfishes?
So this was, again, based on what the fishers told us. I mean, there is, of course, good keys to identifying the species of sawfish, and that's usually more done from the rostrum, the saw in front of the head. And based on the size of the teeth, the spacing between the teeth, how much of the rostrum is covered with teeth, you use that as keys to be able to tell the species apart. So that's what you do as a fishery scientist. But of course, with fishers, it can be a bit different because they don't look at a guidebook. But based on seeing these species often enough, they do come up with answers, and some of them are actually very consistent with what one would read in an ID guide. And that's what we found, is that, okay, while there were less fishers who had actually seen a sawfish, and some of them told us, oh yes, we do know of two different species. And then we asked them, well, why do you say there are two different species? They did tell us that it was, you know, based on looking at the rostrum and how their teeth were shaped, etc. Some of them, of course, said answers like, well, one is bigger and one is smaller, which is not necessarily consistent with different species, because they might have just seen a juvenile and an adult of the same species, for example.
Right.
So yeah, you have to listen quite carefully to the answers and make sure that you know what they're saying and whether what they're saying is actually interpretable as, yes, the new two species.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think is so important that you discuss pretty thoroughly in your paper is how to communicate with the fishers in a way that will want them, will intrigue them or invite them to want to engage with you. And you mentioned that you make sure to interview fishers outside of peak landing and trading times. So that seemed to be very respectful of their working hours. And I wondered if you could describe to our listeners what that experience was like and what process leading up to interviewing the fishers you took to ensure that you had engagement from fishers and that you also were respectful to their work.
So yeah, we've been, like I said, we've been surveying the landing sites since 2017. And actually, Daniel, who is the project lead on our Sri Lanka Elasma Brang project, he's been surveying landing sites since 2010, specifically for mobilitres. And fish landing sites can be really, really busy. Some of them start really early, like the biggest landing sites, they start landing at 3 a.m. So if you want to survey, you need to be there at 3 a.m. And it's very intense. The boats come up to the landing site, fish is being unloaded, there's people sorting it out, there's someone gutting the fish, there's someone else weighing it, another person selling it. Usually fish are auctioned, so there'll be massive groups of people and there'll be really loud, really quick auctions, you know, with their own language, own hand signals, which takes time for our researchers to understand. But so all of that is happening, and at that time, stopping someone to ask them questions is probably not sensible. They don't have the time. They're probably not going to give you good answers. So that's one of the things we did, which was to make sure that, and of course, during the survey, the other thing is we're also surveying. You know, like I said, we are going to the markets and we are documenting the catch, and we'd rather be documenting the catch at that time and then come back a bit later when things have calmed down to actually ask the questions. So yeah, that was one of the things we considered. Specifically for sawfish, we had to do this because, you know, through all our surveys, and it's a lot of survey effort, at least 1,000 sort of person days of effort across the country. And through all of that, we've documented close to 20,000 specimens of Elasma Brangs, but no sawfishes. So none of us have ever seen a sawfish at a fish landing site. So that's why we chose to do it with questionnaires.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my questions for you, is have you ever seen one? Have you seen a live one, if not at the market?
No, none of us have ever seen one. Even Daniel, who's been going since 2010, hasn't seen one. But we had spoken to senior researchers and people who've been documenting fauna in Sri Lanka for much earlier, and they all used to say that they've seen one, but again, not terribly common. Like maybe someone who's been to fish markets for 30 or 40 years could probably count about 8 times that they've seen one. So not very common.
Right, yeah. And you also mentioned the article, and you just mentioned that it can take time as a researcher to learn the hand signals that they're using. And you also mentioned in the article that there's 2 languages in Sri Lanka. So were there any challenges with making sure that you, again, were inclusive with ensuring that they felt comfortable or could communicate? And I just want to emphasize for our listeners the importance of making sure that you're communicating with locals in their local language. So could you describe for our listeners the importance of that?
Yes. So yeah, that's a good question. And so one of the things that I would stress on at the start is just basically questionnaire design. So if you're making a questionnaire, make sure you read a lot of other questionnaires before you design what you're going to design. So this project we did in collaboration with Dr. Rima Jabado of the ILAFMA project, who's also currently the chair of the IUCN Shark Specialist Group. So she did bring her experience to this in terms of designing questionnaires and knowing what to ask, but she also incorporated our local knowledge into the questionnaires. So it was a jointly designed questionnaires. So what worked in our favor was that, well, we've been serving Sri Lankan fisheries quite intensely. So we had good networks and good strong networks with the fishers. And so that helped a lot. So that's something that I would advise anyone who's kind of designing questionnaires to do is, you know, you pick a study where you have a good amount of background information and that you have already built up a stronger working relationship with whoever you're going to interview, because it's quite hard to be someone new who shows up and starts asking questions.
Yeah.
That comes in with the languages as well. There's 2 languages in Sri Lanka, and we had researchers who spoke both, and then they went to parts of the country where they would be able to communicate effectively. This also happened because that's where they used to survey. So our survey team also kind of is designed in a way that we are going to the places where we are most comfortable speaking to the fishers. So we've also developed relationships with the fishers. So that comes together quite nicely. So that works as well. And it's always nice to get your questionnaire vetted by as many people as you can before you start.
I think that's really, really good advice. I've seen published articles that discuss when people go to a country that's not their native country and they don't engage with locals, how much critical information that they miss, and not to mention how disrespectful it can end up being to locals. And in terms of conservation efforts, I just read an article where outside resources came in and made all these recommendations that were totally missing the actual life history data of the species they were trying to protect because they didn't engage the locals. And that's just something that I really want to stress, is that if you're going to research a community, an ecosystem, you always want to engage the locals, especially if you're not from that country. You absolutely need to be working with a group that's already there that can help you interpret between fishers if you don't speak the language, because that's definitely something that I'll have to be doing as well, is making sure that I have somebody that's helping me engage with the people that are invested in that ecosystem.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, developing local capacity is very, very important. Because, you know, in the end, like you say, even if you come in and you work somewhere, it's the local researchers who are going to take the research forward, who are going to make management recommendations, and it's what should be done, and it's how it should be. Yeah.
Yeah. So the importance that you're discussing with these fishers is trying to basically backtrack the decline that you saw in Sri Lanka with sawfishes. And when you surveyed the respondents, basically indicated that only 39% could even identify sawfishes. And I was curious, was this surprising to you, or is that something that you would have expected because they're functionally extinct around Sri Lanka?
Yeah, so yes, 39% of the respondents that we interviewed could identify sawfishes. And yeah, like you say, because we hadn't seen them in most of our surveys, we were really not expecting that number to be too high. So 39% was kind of, yeah, okay, that's expected. But you know, what was alarming in this 39% number was that we saw very strong age-based correlation. So we had respondents from age groups, you know, above 70 to in their 20s. And what we had was that when you went into the age group above the age of 70, there were 8 people that we managed to speak to, but all 8 of them could identify a sawfish. So we showed them a picture of a sawfish and all of them told us that this is a sawfish, gave us a local name, you know, very confidently described the features. And so, you know, we were confident that yes, they're not looking at a picture and describing what it is, but they actually know what that fish is. But then we had respondents under the age of 30, and there was 39 people who we spoke to under the age of 30, and none of them could identify a sawfish. They had no idea what that was. So, I mean, that's quite a strong contrast, because, you know, in an age gap of about 40 years, you have people who know, everybody who knows what it is and nobody who knows what it is. And, you know, we designed our questionnaires in a way that the question, I mean, the answers could be compared to other regions across the world where similar questionnaire studies were done. So this was one of the most striking results, because in the UAE, when Dr. Jabado, who was our collaborator on this, she did a similar questionnaire. In the UAE, everyone under the age of 30 could identify a sawfish. Hmm. Even in Tanzania, which was a recent study, under the age of 20, there was still like 10% of respondents who could identify a sawfish. So yeah, it wasn't surprising that the number was small, but it was surprising how contrasting it was across the age groups.
Yeah, I found that extremely striking as well.
Yeah.
Are they functionally extinct in Tanzania as well?
That was the inference from the paper, that they had like similar results to what we have. Maybe slightly more levels of knowledge than we had in Sri Lanka, but not very high. Whereas something like the UAE, a lot of people had seen sawfishes, you know, across the age groups. I think pretty much everyone who was asked could describe what a sawfish was. So yeah, that was quite striking.
Yeah. And I think one of the other things I found a bit striking was that of the respondents that could identify sawfishes, only 26% could identify both species, and they all but one person was all from the north side of Sri Lanka. Is that probably because that's where the two species overlapped in Sri Lanka, was historically but in the north side of Sri Lanka?
Yeah, so that's not something that we know. I mean, it is a fairly small country, and we never had data of what the spatial variation across the country was. So that's not something we know. But if you kind of look at Sri Lanka, what you notice is that in the west, the south, and the east, the continental shelf kind of drops off really, really close to the shore. So, you know, you could go about 20 or 30 kilometers out and you could hit 3,000 meters of water, which is quite dramatic. And that's also probably why species such as blue whales come so close to shore, because there's a lot of depth really close to shore. And in fact, there's a harbor on the east coast called Trincomalee, which is a very natural harbor. But like within the harbor, you have a depth of up to 800 meters of water. So it's a very dramatic sort of shelf.
That's a huge drop off.
Yeah, that is massive. So, but the north is a bit different, because, you know, from the north and you're kind of coming into India, like the Indian subcontinent, and it's really, really shallow water. And there's lagoons all around Sri Lanka, but But if you just look at the map of Sri Lanka, there's a lot of complexity in those lagoons once you go further north. So the north kind of ticks both check boxes. It has a lot of shallow water and it has a lot of lagoons. And the sawfishes are coastal species. That's the two things they like. And so in our study in general, we just had more sort of fishers' ecological knowledge coming in from the north. This percentage of how many respondents could identify sawfishes or had seen sawfishes, it was a bit higher in the north of Sri Lanka. A lot of people, we had only about 9 people who said they'd frequently seen sawfishes, but again, all of them were from the north. Culturally as well, sawfishes, you know, because they're massive, majestic creatures, usually in coastal waters, they do become a part of culture. And you know, you have sawfishes on stamps, sawfishes on currency notes, sawfishes in culture where they become part of like coming of age rituals and stuff.
Right.
We didn't get that a lot in Sri Lanka, but the only thing we got is like in some parts of the north, they told us that they donate sawfish rostra to churches for good luck.
Yeah.
So literally like most of the information that we got came from the north. And so I think that's why even the two species thing came from the north, because there just probably were more sawfishes there than anywhere else.
Yeah. Now that you've described the topography off of the coastline, that makes total sense. And that's also where the fishers indicated they saw the pups as well, was just in the north. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, the pups was just four fishers who could tell us when they saw pups. But yeah, most of the fishers who said, yes, we've seen pups were all from the north. I think there's just one who was not.
Yeah. Yeah, the fishers just provided so much information, and I also found it really incredible how accurate they were able to even say, like, what year. In the paper, you indicated they were able to kind of time it based on life events that happened when they last saw that sawfish. And so you actually were able to see what seasons even those sawfishes showed up around the coastlines that these fishers had experiences with them. And I found that incredibly interesting because you could almost get an idea of their life history or their movement patterns based on when these fishers indicated they saw the sawfish.
Yeah, that was actually one of the more, given how little positive data came out of it in terms of how many people had actually seen a sawfish, I think that was one of the most surprisingly consistent results that we got, which is you could literally map, yes, seen a sawfish with the monsoon or the wet season. And that's been documented in other studies as well. So, you know, because these species are highly coastal species that move in and out of lagoons quite a bit, during the wet season, there's a lot more connectivity. So in the dry season, your lagoon kind of gets split into little smaller water bodies with less connectivity between them. But once it's wet season, everything is connected. So you're more likely to have sawfish trying to move in and out or around lagoons. The other thing could just be kind of serendipitous, which is all of the fishers that we spoke to were marine fishers. So you know, just to give you some background, this study wasn't just about sawfishes. There were other species that we asked them about as well. So guitarfish and wedgefish, which are called rhino rays.
Very cool.
It was a much larger study, and we're going to publish the other results a bit later, but sawfishes was one component of it. So we focused a lot on marine fishers, and during the wet season, these fishers can't go far out to sea because the seas are rough. So right. It's also possible that they're just staying a lot closer to shore, or possibly fishing inside lagoons during the wet season as well. And so they're more likely to encounter sawfishes during that time. So it could be a mix of both. Like the sawfishes are moving around quite a bit more, but also our interviewees are staying closer to shore as well.
Because the lagoons, you're saying they're connected because it's a wet season, so there's a lot more rainfall. Do the sawfishes tolerate pretty brackish water?
So studies have, there's been a lot of movement studies. So tag sawfishes and seeing what they do. And they have been documented to go fairly far up rivers as well, and even depending on the species, coming down into marine environments as well. But yeah, sawfish is a bit like bull sharks in the sense that they're quite adept at going up and down between not even brackish, but almost fresh water sometimes, and going into the sea as well.
That's really cool. I think the adaptations that elasmobranchs experience is just so fascinating to me. And every time I have the opportunity to interview another researcher, I just learn so much about that species because I certainly am not familiar with sawfishes. We have them sparingly in Florida, but I've certainly never seen one and never really researched or dove into their life history. So it's really interesting to learn about how they're able to really adapt to their the ecosystem that they're within. And any elasmobranch that's able to go into more fresh water, there are several species that can do that, but I just find that so, so interesting. So one of the other big findings that you indicate in your paper is that there's a clear drop-off in sightings since 1990. And based on the beliefs that the respondents said was this was likely due to increased fishing efforts, and the aquaculture industry also started to take off. And that is also lining up with the historical data that we have, right, of those things happening. There was an increased fishing effort, and aquaculture started to become a larger industry. So I wondered if you could kind of describe to our listeners those events and why that might have been threatening to the population of sawfishes.
So, yes. So like you say, we asked the respondents who had caught a sawfish, well, why do you think, we asked them first, whether do you think they've declined or not? And all of them said, yes, they've declined. And then we asked them, why do you think they declined? And the most common reason was fishing pressure. So saying that, oh, there's more boats now than there used to be, or the fishing gear we use now is a lot more like trawling happens, or we use fishing nets, and the sawfish with their unique rostra are very easily entangled in these nets. So these were the reasons they gave us, and they're fairly consistent reasons, accepted reasons globally for what is causing sawfish decline. Overfishing and this destructive sort of non-specific fishing gear are the primary contributors to declines in sawfishes. And so yeah, we did get that data. It's also important to remember that sawfishes, like all sharks and rays, they have very conservative life histories. So they mature very late, they give birth to very few young, and they have very, very long gestation periods. I mean, in the end, they behave more like terrestrial mammals, like elephants or leopards, compared to fish like tuna and snappers. So
I love that comparison. I think that's such a good point, because that's something I try to explain as well, is a lot of elasmobranchs, they don't reproduce until very late age. It takes a long time. So if you're fishing them faster than they're able to age and start reproduce and replenishing the population, of course you'll see population decline. But I don't think a lot of people are actually familiar with reproduction of elasmobranchs like sawfishes. So I think comparing them to elephants is actually, yeah, that's brilliant. That's a really great comparison.
Yeah, those comparisons, and they're very true. I mean, they are exactly like that. And the unfortunate thing is people think they're like fish, which is, well, like teleosts rather, but like bony fish, which spawn, and they spawn many times a year and produce potentially many young. So elasmobranchs are not like that. Sharks and rays are not like that. And that kind of showed up in our data, because Sri Lanka had this unfortunate civil war, which lasted from the early 80s up to 2009. And at that time, there were many restrictions in the north of the country where, like you said before, most of the sawfish information came from. And that was a 30-year, literally de facto marine protected area. You couldn't really fish as freely as you would have wanted to. And even that 30-year period didn't really result in recoveries of the sawfish population. Most of the respondents, like I said, half of the respondents said they hadn't seen a sawfish since the 1990s, and only 10 of the respondents said that they'd seen one in the last 10 years. We did have anecdotal information saying that, from fishermen saying that, you know, after the war ended, if you went over to the north or the east coast, you could catch a lot of fish. So there were recoveries in fish populations, but because sawfish is potentially reproduce so slowly, and they have probably declined quite a bit before that anyways, they never really recovered in spite of that embargo on fishing.
So because of that basically 30-year moratorium, and that you still don't see sawfishes coming back, do you think that there's any possibility that continued protection would potentially bring them back? Or do you think at this point their numbers are just so low, there's no way to reestablish that population?
So, yeah, pragmatically speaking, given there's no precedence for this, right? In the developing world where there is such a high level of fishing pressure and, you know, everyone's so dependent on fishing, there is no precedence for sawfish recoveries. The only sort of recovery we've seen is in the United States, where, like you said, in Florida, there was some tangible recovery of sawfish populations, but that was also with like very, very strong legislation and very, very good implementation, which is not so easy to implement in the developing world. So, right. Yeah, pragmatically right. Speaking, I would doubt that this would be possible.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And one of the things you touched on for a moment there that I want to explain more to our listeners, because if you're not in marine science, you might not actually know about this, that mangroves are really critical ecosystems. Mangroves are a type of tree, and they're in lagoons and off the shoreline, and they establish these really tall root systems along the coastline. We've historically had them really thick in Florida, but those were all taken out, a lot of them, not all of them, but they were extensively removed in the US and really around the world, partly because of aquaculture. And I wondered if you could explain a little bit for our listeners what that looks like. You know, why does aquaculture want to establish those facilities where the mangroves are, and why does that cause such issues for species like sawfishes?
Yes, so we had two sort of hotspots for sawfishes in Sri Lanka. They were in the north of Sri Lanka. One was a marine hotspot like we spoke about, which is in the region surrounding the really shallow water between Sri Lanka and India. The other hotspot was in a lagoon in the northwest of Sri Lanka called the Puttalam Lagoon. So this is a really big lagoon. And the respondents there, like while you said, we had 39% of respondents overall in Sri Lanka being able to identify sawfishes. The two localities around the lagoon, it was 73%. So definitely we had a lot of sawfishes there. But again, it was the same story, which is none of them said they had seen a sawfish since the 1990s. And we tried to explore why. So while looking up data, what we found was that Puttalam Lagoon in the 70s, from the 70s onwards, became a hotspot for aquaculture. So a lot of prawn farms started coming up, shrimp or prawn farms started coming up there. And there was a 63% loss in mangrove cover from 1981 to 1992. And like you said, mangroves are very critical for sawfishes. They're essentially very critical for most ecosystems. They're at the edge of land. So, you know, in these parts, it shows up quite critically when we have cyclones, because you see areas where there's good mangrove cover stay protected, whereas areas where the mangrove cover has been depleted, you usually have a lot of coastal erosion during cyclones. So that was one thing that we noticed. And, you know, aquaculture does have its benefits, but implementing good aquaculture is very, very hard.
Yeah.
And that's something that we've seen here as well, which is that a lot of these prawn farms which came up around the lagoon slowly had to shut down because they, you know, managing these prawn farms was very technically challenging. And yes, they generated employment, but they also cost a lot of money to run. There was probably a lack of sustainable financing, disease outbreaks, and you know, having them and not having them well managed also affects the water quality, because a lot of the water that comes out from these prawn farms is very nutritional. And so it if released into the lagoon, you have sort of algal blooms, and you're just affecting the chemistry of the water, which affects a lot of fish. And in turn, once it starts affecting the smaller organisms, it builds up and escalates and starts affecting the larger organisms. So with sawfishes, that's what we speculate happened in the lagoon. And the basis for that was a lake in Madagascar called Lake Kinkoni, which used to have a lot of sawfish. And they introduced tilapia into the lake. And I think 10 years after that, the sawfish kind of disappeared from that lake.
Mm-hmm.
So the tilapia farms kind of affected the chemistry of the lake, which changed the flora in the lake, and then that slowly worked its way up to affecting the sawfish population.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge mistake I think a lot of people make all around the world, is introducing species because perhaps it might be a good game fish, right? Like tilapia might be something really interesting for the community to go fish, but they don't always, historically, we haven't considered how that introduced species might completely change the ecosystem because they serve such a different ecosystem role in that ecosystem. So they might prey against things. This is also, lionfish is a really common species that was introduced that people talk about. The prey items that lionfish prey on don't recognize it as a predator because they didn't evolve together. And so lionfish have completely wiped out fish diversity, especially in the Caribbean, after they were introduced, we believe, off the coast of Florida. So that's something I think a lot of people should know, is that you can't necessarily fix problems or create solutions just by introducing a species. You can start creating an imbalance with the species that are already there. And also with the aquaculture, I just really want to emphasize, like, this happened in Florida as well. We ripped out our mangroves for shrimp farms. And shrimp is obviously a really high-valued aquaculture product. But in turn, you remove all of these really critical mangrove forests. And if you've never seen a mangrove, it might be hard to picture. But go look them up. They're really critical trees that provide shelter for larval fish and basically larval anything along the coastline. And having that type of protection when species are small is super important because they provide the foundation for the entire ecosystem. So all those larval fish, all those juvenile sharks and rays, they rely on this kind of safe place where they can fit through all those roots, but the predators can't. And so removing those mangroves essentially puts all of those larval fish at risk, all of those larval juvenile elasmobranchs, you know, they don't have that safety area anymore. So it's really important to know why it's so critical when you start impeding on the ecosystem, how that can end up having really cascading effects on everything around. Actually, thank you so much for just explaining so much about the process that you went through with this article. I just, again, find it so important. And you've learned so much from Fisher's, this historical information about sawfishes. And I wondered, is there anything else about the paper that you found surprising or that we should talk about?
So, this was a sort of a study in history. And you know, I think one of the most, you have to learn from history. So what we documented was there were sawfishes in Sri Lanka. They were not as uncommon as they are now, but they're likely to be, as we discussed at the start, likely to be functionally extinct. And, you know, we kind of have to discuss what can we do going forward. So should you start working really hard to promote sawfish population recovery and invest a lot of time and a lot of effort into something like this. And the pragmatic answer, like we said, to that is probably not. There's no precedence for it. We don't know how to do it. It's very unlikely to work. So we should still be protecting these species. So yes, whatever few sawfishes are left, efforts should be made to make sure that any sawfish caught from now on is released. And you know, there have been release programs in Indonesia and stuff which have been implemented, where they are still catching sawfishes a bit more frequently. So yes, a good legislation to protect sawfishes, a good release program to encourage fishers and to train them to release any accidentally caught individuals, that has to be done. We work closely with the Department of Fisheries in Sri Lanka, and we hope that they will. I mean, we have presented the findings of this paper to them, and we hope that they will act on protecting these species. We must obviously, we have to learn a lesson, like I said, and focus on management for other fishes which are potentially going to follow the same path. So like we spoke about, the guitarfish and the wedgefish, which are, you know, in the same order as sawfishes, there are documented declines in these species where you have long-term data sets, you know, up to 80-90% declines over 10 years. And so we need, in the Sri Lankan perspective, we have documented these species at our landing sites, and you know, something needs to be done about them. Some sort of protections need to come in for sure. Sri Lanka has done quite a bit. Fully protected thresher sharks, whale sharks, oceanic white tip sharks, which are fully protected in Sri Lanka. And you know, all of this centers on proactive management over reactive management. So you need to start taking precautionary steps before it becomes too late, as opposed to responding to a situation which has already gone from bad to worse. Mm. I think that's probably what I would say we need to end with, is, you know, we need to do something with the other species, which, you know, for now are okay, but the current trends don't seem to indicate that they will be okay in the future. So one of the things we've noticed is that through our surveys and over time is that even the fishers are slowly beginning to understand this aspect of sharks and rays are not other fish. I mean, a lot of the older fishers acknowledge that, you know, we've had massive declines and something needs to be done about them. A lot of the younger fishers we interact with regularly, they get to know about these sort of life history challenges, etc., sometimes through social media actually now, which is really good. I mean, we've heard a fisher, we've overheard fishers telling other fishers when a mobulid is landed, for example, that, oh, have you noticed that, you know, this one only has one pup when we cut it open sometimes. So they are seeing that, you know, there is an issue. And that's one of the gratifying aspects of this, that there is, albeit a small number of fishers who know that something needs to be done. And, you know, it is a start, and we need to build on this quickly before other sharks and rays sort of start following the same path as sawfishes.
Yeah, I think that's such a critical message, and it's so good to be proactive. I think often we're not proactive enough about the conservation we do. We're often reactive. We don't really do much until it's almost too late. So I think, just like you said, when we are already seeing a trend with species declining, we need to act fast. We need to act proactively before it's too late and we see similar results like we did with sawfishes. I would hate to see a world where a lot of elasmobranchs continue to decline and reach a similar fate. So absolutely, I think we need to act proactively, and it's just so, the work you're doing is just so critically important. So thank you so much for sharing this work. I'm really excited to continue following the work you do out of Sri Lanka. And I am curious, you said at the beginning that you know, again, this the organization you're working for right now, Blue Resources, started in 2017. And a lot of people are trying to develop their careers and look for organizations to work for. What experience did you have before reaching this organization? Did you work with the government before then? Or what kind of experience would you recommend our listeners to try to get so that they can do similar work that you're doing?
So I had quite a non-conventional route to get to this. I didn't study marine biology at university. I actually studied chemistry. And I was a dive instructor for a few years. So that's sort of what got me into the marine realm. And I had worked in Sri Lanka before. And then when the idea of Blue Resources Trust came about with Nishan and Daniel, who I knew from before, I kind of joined in the team to start off on this. So yeah, you can have a very odd path to get to this. It need not be terribly conventional. I think if you care about this, if you're associated with marine conservation in any way, I mean, being a dive instructor is a very remote way, but also kind of direct in the sense that you're always in the water and you see all of this. So yeah, there can be fairly varied paths to this. I think if someone is interested, I would just advise them to approach organizations and try and do some work. To be honest, we've all spent a lot of time without necessarily being paid very well to start off. I mean, it's an investment, yeah, in the end. You know, even if you're doing something sometimes for free, it's still a sort of investment. You're investing your time into something, and then, you know, eventually you get your breaks. But you know, it's a competitive field, just like it, but every field is competitive. So yeah, I would advise people to just pursue it as best as they can.
That is such incredible advice, and that's something we talk about on the podcast a lot too, is that it's not always a linear path to get into marine science. So getting involved however you can is certainly is excellent advice. I also think it's important to acknowledge, like, a lot of people are here because we're passionate about the ocean and we're passionate about seeing conservation of the environment, of the ocean resources. And so, you know, there's been a lot of criticism, especially lately, that we do what we're doing because we're trying to make money from fisheries. And I think people have absolutely no idea that this is a completely passion-driven field. It is not a money-driven field. So it's not for the faint of heart, but don't give up. If I love that you're an instructor. I also worked as a dive master for a number of years, and I think diving is a really excellent way to get involved with the ocean, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily the only way. I mean, there's a lot of good marine biologists who don't dive at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, it's a sort of serendipitous way to get in. But yeah, I think in the end, if you have a passion for it, even if you learn to code or you learn to make good graphics or something, it's all an avenue to find yourself in this in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. We're now at our favorite part of the podcast, where we're going to ask for a field story from you. So do you have a story from the field that you would like to share with our listeners that might be inspiring or just kind of funny or anecdotal, or just something that was important to you when you were in the field?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, one of the unfortunate aspects of being the director of operations of a really small marine organization is that you don't get to go into the field as much as you would like. So it is a managerial role, and so we're mostly not in the field. But we do get nice stories from our researchers who do go into the field. And I think, yeah, the one that I can think of, which was really funny, was during this survey, actually. Again, this is in that far northern reaches of the Putlam Lagoon. So really hard to get to. You kind of drive to where the road literally ends, and then you get on a boat, and then you take a long 2-hour boat ride to these isolated, very isolated islands. And you are in a place where they, you know, our staff were living in a hut, and they had no electricity. They had to carry their drinking water supplies, their food, their solar panels to charge up their field cameras. So yeah, they enjoyed it. I mean, when they came back, they were really, really happy. And I think one of the days they actually needed to finally have a bath. So they were advised to go into this small little local pond. The advice was make sure you avoid the crocs and the elephants and get yourself into that pond, which they managed to do. And so they were in this pond. They were having a bath, if you may. And a group of squid fishermen show up after having sorted their catch, which means they were covered head to toe in squid ink. And without a word, without telling them anything, they all just jumped into the water with them. So the water just became inky black while our field staff were in the water. So yeah, that was quite funny. They learned their lesson. For the rest of the days that they were there, they made sure that they went into the pond and got out before the squid fishermen showed up, because that's the only way they had like a clean water bath. But yeah, those are funny stories and something that I guess we miss sometimes when we have to do this work. But you know, it's nice to be able to have or be able to mentor the next generation of marine biologists who get to, we've done this before, and now they get to do this and potentially lead their own projects as well. So yeah, it's a small price to pay.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I just think that is so funny. You probably ended up dirtier than when you entered the bath.
Probably. And probably fishier as well. Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much, Akshay. We so appreciate your time and this wonderful work that you're doing. I can't wait to see the next publication that you discussed that might be coming out about other elasmobranchs and coral reef work that you're all doing. So where can our listeners follow you? Where should they be watching for that work coming out?
So Blue Resources Trust is on the usual suspects of social media. So we do have an Instagram and a Facebook account, and we're also on Twitter. So, I mean, if you search for Blue Resources Trust, we should pop up. So please go ahead and do that.
I'm going to do that right now. I'm so excited. Thank you so much again for your time.
Thanks so much for taking the time as well.
And until next time, we'll swim you later.